Good morning. This is Howell Jackson, and I'd like to welcome you back to the second lecture in my series for the Law Department of Peking University. Today's lecture will primarily focus on the regulation of depository institutions. I want to introduce the field to the students in the lecture series, talk for a few moments about justification for regulation in this field, and then spend the bulk of our time discussing activities restrictions for depository institutions. At the end of the hour, I will discuss an assignment that I would like students to undertake before the end of the week. There is an additional worksheet to be downloaded from my webpage, which you will need to get before you can complete this assignment. I will discuss the details at the end of the class. Before turning to the substantive issues, however, there are once again several administrative items that I would like to discuss. The first concerns the discussion groups. One point I'd like to make about the discussion groups is I have created a unique discussion group for each lecture. If you have comments or questions about the lecture, please try to post them on the discussion group associated with that lecture. So, for this week's lecture, Lecture 2, please post your comments and questions on the discussion group for Lecture 2. Also, in posting comments and questions in the discussion groups, there are certain formatting conventions that you must follow in order for your postings to be easily read by other members of the class. I have myself included a brief description of these conventions in one of the postings. In general, what I would recommend that you do is make sure that you preview your posting before you actually put it on the web page. If there is some problem with the format when you preview the lecture, when you preview the comment, go back and try to correct it. In general, what you need to do is include a space between each paragraph and also begin each paragraph at the left-hand margin of the page. For some reason, if you start with a space or two, the formatting program does not work properly. I apologize for the pickiness of this particular software, but I hope you will get used to it over the course of the semester. Another administrative item concerns the casebook and supplement. I gather from Mr. Tong that these documents have still not yet cleared customs in Peking, but they're expected to do so within the relatively near future. Once again this week, I have extracted an excerpt from my casebook and put it on the web for you to download. I hope you will have the casebooks in your possession by next week. And throughout this lecture, I indicate where additional readings can be found in the casebook if you want to know more about the topics discussed in the class. In any rate, hopefully by next week, the casebook supplement will be available and you will have them in your possession. One final comment administratively concerns participation in the discussion groups. As I mentioned last week, a number of students have already posted comments on the discussion groups, and the one substantive comment that has been posted, I have already made a response to. I very much hope that all students in the class will try to post comments. This is an important part of the course, both for helping you understand the materials that I'm presenting in these lectures, and also for me to get a better idea of your interests and backgrounds. Even though it may be a little bit unfamiliar and difficult to you at first, I would very much urge all of the students in the class to try to make postings each week. Let's turn now to the substance of today's lecture. Looking for a moment at the outline of the lecture series, which I shared with you in my overview lecture, we are turning now to our discussion of depository institutions, having completed an introduction to financial institutions in last week's class. Today's topics will include the justifications for regulation in this field and also an introduction to activities restrictions for depository institutions. In subsequent lectures, we will complete our analysis of depository institution regulation in the United States. But before turning to the major topics of today's lecture, I would like to say a few words about the historical background of regulation of depository institutions in the United States. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this topic, it is covered in Chapter 2 of our casebook on the pages indicated on this slide. The basic point to be made about depository institution regulation in the United States, and for most of our history, that means banking regulation, is that it dates back to the earliest years of the Republic. Shortly after the American Revolution, there were established in the United States the first and second banks of the United States, which operated as a combination of central bank and primary lending institution for our new nation. At the time, the banking industry was a controversial subject in American politics. The primary question concerned whether or not the central government, that is, the federal government of the United States, should be charged with organizing banks, or whether that activity should be left to the individual states. In part, this was the subject of a number of controversial court cases in our early history, including the case of McCulloch v. Maryland. The issue was temporarily resolved in the 1830s when President Jackson vetoed the Second Bank of the United States charter, and it went out of existence shortly thereafter. Incidentally, I just want you to know that I am no relation to that President Jackson. For a number of years, banking was conducted at the state level and supervised to the extent supervision existed by state governments. This was a period known as free banking in the United States, and it ran from roughly 1837 until 1863. During this time, the states were the prime regulators of banking in our country, and the period was characterized by rapid growth in the banking industry, with many charters being granted to new banks. In the course of this rapid expansion, a number of banking institutions failed, and there were periodic crises of local banking activity. The period of free banking ended in the middle of the 19th century during the course of the American Civil War. At that time, the federal government again entered the banking field and established a system of national banks. In part, this new banking system was designed to help the federal government finance the Civil War effort, but it also created a new form of banking organization in the United States, the National Bank, which was originally expected to supersede the state banking system. Somewhat surprisingly, in the years after the Civil War, the state banks survived, and since this period, we have operated under what is known as a dual banking system in the United States, with federal banks in the form of national banks chartered by the federal government, and each state having its own separate chartering authority. So in the United States, when organizing a bank, entrepreneurs have a choice between using a state bank charter or a national bank charter. This has been an important element of our banking system over the years. While the dual banking system survived in the 20th century, the trend in this century has been towards an increasingly important role for the federal government in supervising the entire banking structure. This trend began with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Enacted in response to a series of banking panics in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the Federal Reserve Act established a system of reserve banks across the United States and a centralized Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. Through the imposition of reserve requirements and other supervisory techniques, the Federal Reserve System has overseen our national banking structure for most of this century. 20 years after the Federal Reserve System was established, however, the nation's banks were again in a state of crisis. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, there was a substantial amount of difficulty in bank operations, and the country experienced a serious banking crisis in the first few years of that decade. As a result, President Roosevelt, with the assistance of the New Deal Congress, established a number of new bank supervisory agencies, including, most importantly, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which insured the deposits of banks at both the state and national level. In addition, the New Deal legislation imposed substantial restrictions on banking activities and, for the first time, severed relationships between commercial banking and securities activities in the Glass-Steagall Act. We will discuss that act towards the end of the semester and how it is applied in the context of a modern financial services industry. The regulatory structure developed by the Federal Reserve Act and the Banking Act of 1933 established the basic framework for bank supervision in the United States today. Following the 1930s, there was a relatively stable period of banking in this country. The one significant piece of legislation in the next few decades was the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956, which we will also be discussing in this course. Unlike prior federal initiatives in the field, the Bank Holding Company Act was not primarily concerned with protecting the solvency of banking institutions. Rather, the Bank Holding Company Act addressed anti-competitive concerns that banking institutions in the United States might be growing too large and gaining too much economic power. Accordingly, the Bank Holding Company Act imposed substantial restrictions on the expansion of banks through the holding company structure. It also limited affiliations between banking organizations and commercial enterprises. The next major development in the banking system of the United States occurred in the late 1980s and early 90s. During the 1980s, there was a substantial crisis in a sector of the depository institution field, which we call the thrift industry. Thrifts, as you may recall from our prior discussions, are specialized depository institutions that deal primarily with individuals and reinvest their assets in commercial loans and other types of consumer credit. During the 1980s, a large number of thrift institutions got into financial difficulties and, in the end, required a substantial bailout from the federal government. In response to the difficulties of the thrift industry, Congress enacted a series of bills in 1989 and 1991 to strengthen and tighten the supervision of depository institutions. We will be discussing a number of the particular provisions adopted in these acts over the course of the semester. More recently, in the 1990s, the stability of the depository institution sector of our economy has greatly improved. And in light of these improvements, there have been a number of liberalizations of longstanding restrictions on geographic and other limitations, which we will discuss over the course of the semester. This is a very brief overview of the history of depository institutions in the United States, and I would encourage you all to take a look at the casebook when you have time to fill in a little more of the details. But it is important to have a basic sense of the structure of our regulatory system in order to understand the materials that we will be discussing both today and in subsequent classes. Now, however, I'd like to turn to the main topic for discussion in today's class. The question, why are depository institutions subject to special legal rules? Those of you who have signed up to take this course may accept the existence of these specialized regulatory structures as something that's natural and obvious. But as an initial matter, I would encourage you to step back for a moment and to think about this question seriously. In the United States, at least, there is a well-developed set of legal rules for corporations and also economic relations in the form of contracts. For many areas of commercial activity, these basic regulatory structures are considered to be adequate. However, in the United States and in most other countries around the world, we do observe specialized legal systems for depository institutions, and for that matter, many other types of financial intermediaries. And the question I'd like to consider at this point is, why do we have these additional rules? This is a question I introduce in the first chapter of our casebook in a discussion on pages 7 and 8. One reason why we regulate depository institutions in a special way has to concern the solvency of those institutions and making sure that they remain solvent. There are a number of reasons why we might want to do that, and I think it's important to untangle different strains of analysis here. In general, though, it is both to protect the bank customers and also to protect the economy at large. I think there are separate reasons besides solvency regulation which also factor into our regulation, at least in the United States, and also, I believe, in other countries with which I am familiar. I want to break out these other public or social goals, too, in subsequent discussions. To introduce these lines of justification, I think it's important to recall our lecture of last week, where we looked at individual financial intermediaries and how they do business with the public. Consider, for example, unidentified institution A, the Cambridge Savings Bank. In many respects, this was the simplest depository institution that we looked at last week. Its liabilities consisted almost entirely of deposits with a relatively small capital reserve in the form of retained earnings, and its assets were primarily invested in loans of one sort or another. This is characteristic of depository institutions. There is a relatively small amount of capital backing a relatively large amount of deposits, and these resources are invested in various sorts of financial assets. One issue which I alluded to last week, and I want to emphasize again at this point, is the nature of the individuals or entities that supply fundings to banks. They are what we refer to as depositors in the United States, and typically there are a large number of depositors with a relatively small amount of funds invested in an institution, which then aggregates the funds and reallocates them in the form of financial assets. In fact, one of the reasons for financial intermediaries existing is to take advantage of the economies of scale that their size allows. By aggregating a large number of depositors, they can make kinds of investments that no individual depositor would be able to afford, and, of course, they also offer the advantages of diversification to depositors by dividing up their individual investments and reallocating them to a large number of separate borrowers. This structure, I think, helps explain why we have a special regulatory system for depository institutions. Consider, for example, the issue of institutional solvency. One of the reasons that we protect the solvency of depository institutions through a mandatory set of regulatory requirements is that we want to protect the investors, that is the depositors, from suffering losses on their investment in the intermediary. In other contexts, those that supply capital to corporations are generally thought capable of looking out for their own interests and deciding in which enterprise to invest their funds. But with financial intermediaries, by their nature, a large number of individuals make separate investment decisions. Many of these individuals lack financial sophistication. Most lack the time with which to analyze the resources. And of course, since there are such a large number of depositors for each intermediary, it's quite difficult for them to get together and organize themselves to negotiate an appropriate lending relationship for their intermediaries. Within the economic literature, these problems are sometimes called collective action problems, and the barriers that the depositors face in organizing themselves is sometimes referred to as transactions cost. But the main point to make here is sometimes the justification for governmental regulation in this field is to try to develop the kind of restrictions that the depositors themselves would want to impose had they the time and the capabilities to negotiate their own relationship with the institution. So, one reason that we regulate depository institutions is to protect investors through imposing the contract that they themselves might have insisted upon had they the time and resources to. This is not, however, the only reason why we protect investors. In certain respects, we try to make sure that they have absolute protection for the terms of their investment. In the United States, for example, our federal deposit insurance system is designed to prevent certain depositors, those with less than $100,000 of deposits, from suffering any loss on their investments. In essence, we preclude these borrowers from taking any sort of risk in their bank deposits. We require them to have FDIC insurance, and we thus prevent them from suffering any losses. This absolute protection of terms of investment is slightly different than the preceding explanation. It's possible to imagine depositors wanting to assume some degree of risk in bank deposits. And in the United States, new intermediaries are always popping up that look something like banks, but impose some degree of risk on the depositors. And one of the questions we have to consider in this context is whether or not we should allow them to take these risks or whether we should force them to have an absolutely safe depository relationship. Another line of justification for preserving the solvency of depository institutions concerns the problem of externalities, which again is a term that refers to a particular kind of problem, which is, in essence, the costs of bank failures on the rest of society. Sometimes regulation is justified in order to prevent such negative externalities from taking place. For example, if one were of the view that other members of society would have to bail out depositors should they lose money on their bank investments, one might take the view that regulation of depository institutions should be increased to prevent those other members of society from bearing the losses. In essence, we would force the depository institution to internalize the risk of social losses through regulatory restrictions. Another more common justification for regulation of the banking industry concerns what's known as systemic costs, problems of runs, panics, disruption of creditor relationships that are thought to be associated with bank failures. In the United States, systemic problems from bank failures, both at the beginning of this century and in the Great Depression, contributed greatly to the development of our banking structure. The general view was that society at large has a strong interest in maintaining the solvency of the banking system, and therefore imposes regulatory restrictions on the banking system. You should note how different this justification is to some of the justifications I've described earlier. For example, the collective solution to transaction cost justification is an effort to create the contract that depositors themselves would have wanted to impose. These depositors might well want to assume a certain degree of risk that a banking institution would fail in return, presumably, for a higher rate of return. If regulation were solely based on this consideration, representing the interests of depositors, it would not take into account the systemic cost of bank failures, because those costs go beyond the direct interests of the depositors. Accordingly, it is often the case that bank regulation goes beyond the level of supervision that the individual depositors themselves might ask for, and is one of the reasons why one sees pervasive regulation in this field. Solvency regulation, however, is not the only justification for the supervision of depository institutions. As I mentioned earlier, there are other social and political goals involved in the regulation of this field, at least in most countries. One general category I refer to as redistributive norms. By this, I mean the decision of many societies to use financial intermediaries in general and depository institutions in particular for affecting certain social policies. In the United States, for example, there has been a long tradition requiring banking institutions to reinvest at least a portion of the deposits they raise back into the community from which those deposits originated. These requirements have taken various forms over history. Currently, the best illustration of this phenomenon is something known as the Community Reinvestment Act, which requires depository institutions in the United States to serve the credit needs of low and middle income borrowers within their sphere of business. There are other examples of preferences for certain kinds of investments in the depository institution field, and more generally, there are a number of illustrations of imposed cross-subsidies on financial intermediaries that we'll see over the course of the semester. It is, I think, an entirely appropriate question to ask whether it is a matter of sound policy to use financial intermediaries in this manner. But at this point, I would simply observe that, generally speaking, there is a tendency to do at least some of this social engineering through the regulatory restrictions imposed on depository institutions. There are, I think, also other considerations of political economy that often factor into the structure of depository institution regulation. In the United States, for example, there have been historically various kinds of restrictions imposed on the geographic expansion of banking institutions and the affiliation of banks with other sorts of business enterprises that I think are best understood as reflecting political decisions by the national government and in some instances the state government to control the structure of the banking industry. Presumably these decisions are made in order to align the industry with public sentiment or theories of political economy. In the United States, for example, the tendency has been to try to restrain the growth of individual banks so that they not dominate our economic environment. There are, of course, some economic or efficiency justifications for these restrictions, but I think they are also properly understood as political decisions. In other jurisdictions, one sees restrictions on foreign ownership of banking institutions, which again, I think, might be considered an example of political economy. One of the interesting things about the other public and social goals that I'm outlining in this slide is that oftentimes they are in tension with the goal of preserving the solvency of depository institutions. Redistributive norms, in particular, tend to impose certain costs on depository institutions, which, on balance, might reduce their solvency and make them somewhat more likely to be prone to failure. Considerations of political economy also can have economic costs or efficiency costs when imposed on depository institutions. And one of the interesting elements of balancing that goes on in the regulatory field in this area is considering the extent to which these other public and social policies do threaten the solvency of depository institutions. This is a topic to which I will return from time to time over the course of the semester. One could easily spend an entire course discussing the justifications for the regulation of depository institutions and other financial intermediaries, and we clearly don't have time for that luxury. What I would like you all to remember, however, is there are different kinds of justifications for regulation in this field, not all of which have to do with solvency of the intermediaries. And even under the rubric of solvency regulation, there are different strains of justification. Some are focused precisely on the protection of individual investors, and some have broader societal concerns. I think it is important to keep these different lines of justification in the back of your mind as we approach other materials in this section of the lecture series and later on in the semester. But at this point, I want to move on to the second topic of the depository institution segment of the course, which is activities restrictions on depository institutions. By way of background and introduction to this section of the lecture, let me just discuss for a moment the chartering of banks in the United States. This is a topic that is covered in pages 51 to 66 of our casebook, if you would like additional information. In the United States, the general legal requirement is that banking institutions must be organized under specialized charters. They are not chartered in the same way as ordinary corporations. And in fact, the system of chartering of banks is a very specialized area of the law. In the United States, it is relatively simple to start a corporation. One needs only file a series of papers with local authorities, and business can be started almost immediately. For the chartering of banks and for the creation of most financial intermediaries, there is a much more lengthy chartering process where substantial amounts of information must be supplied to the federal government or the state government, and the review process can extend for multiple months and even years in certain circumstances. This is the first major way in which the regulation of banks differs from ordinary corporations in the United States. I won't deal with the details of chartering in this course. Those of you who are interested can read about it in the casebook, but you should just be aware that there is a specialized statutory structure for banks, both federal and state, as well as parallel systems for other forms of depository institutions that have specific statutory requirements. Once you receive copies of the statutory supplement, you can leaf through some of the principal provisions of our chartering system for national banks. For example, if you look at the Organization of National Bank rules, which can be found in Title 12 of the United States Code, Section 21. You will see the basic rules. There are certain requirements about the number of people who are necessary to organize a national bank. There must be at least 5, and they have to enter into articles of incorporation, which are basically a corporate charter, including certain information and certain provisions that are established under law. These are the procedures under which all national banks are organized. As part of the organization process, just to give another illustration, there is issued an organizational certificate which includes certain information, including, for example, the requirement that the word national be included in the name of the institution and that there be clearly specified the location where the principal business is to be taking place and also certain technical details about capital stock and number of shares. For purposes of this course and this section of the lecture, one thing you should be aware of is that the National Banking Act includes special powers provisions clearly delineating the activities in which national banks can engage. Some of these activities are relatively ministerial, such as adopting a corporate seal and having the power to make contact, but more important is the power to engage in certain banking activities. The relevant provision, which you will see discussed in the cases in the casebook, as well as in the notes and introductory materials, is Section 24(7) of the National Banking Act, which appears on the screen right now. Under this provision, national banks have the powers to all such incidental powers as shall be necessary to carry on the business of banking. And then there is delineated a set of specific powers, discounting and negotiating promissory notes, various other activities which you can read in the full statutory supplement. Later in today's lecture, I will return to this provision in slightly greater detail. But the two issues I want to introduce for the balance of today's lecture relate to the organization of national banks. There are two, I think, principal interesting questions. One question is, how do we ensure, that is, we as regulatory authorities, ensure that everyone who engages in the business of banking actually organizes themselves as banks? If you recall, there is a special chartering authority and chartering rules for banks, but it is not necessarily clear that all the relevant parties will abide by these rules. We must have a mechanism that forces them to go through the registration process to bring them in within our regulatory structure. So that's the first question I want to consider. How do we make sure that banks are in fact organized and comply with our regulatory system? The second question is, once the institutions are organized as banks, why and how do we make sure that these organizations limit themselves to the business of banking? So I'm going to address, for the balance of this lecture, two distinct issues concerning the business of banking. And to address these issues, I'd like you all to take a look at the two cases that I've assigned for today's lecture. The first, an opinion of the Texas Attorney General, and the second, the case of Arnold Tours. For those of you who don't yet have the casebook, copies of these materials are available to be downloaded from our website. Having briefly described the chartering process for national banks in the United States, let me turn now to two questions regarding the so-called business of banking. These questions are explored in the casebook on page 122 to 41, which are the sections included in the portion of the casebook that you can download for today's lecture. There are two separate issues I want to consider here. The first question concerning the business of banking requirement used to determine when particular entities are required to charter themselves as banks and become subject to the bank regulatory system. This is an important element of the American banking system, and I think an important element of any regulatory structure that seeks to oversee depository institutions or other sorts of financial intermediaries. Just because a government organizes a regulatory structure for overseeing banks does not necessarily mean that all intermediaries engaging in banking activity will bring themselves under that regulatory structure. One might imagine that institutions will, in general, be reluctant to allow themselves to be regulated under a system such as a bank regulatory system because of the cost that it imposes on operations, and also because of the restrictions that it imposes on business activities. So, to overcome this resistance, regulatory structures have to have a way of defining what it means to be engaged in the business of banking, and also an enforcement mechanism to bring those engaged in such activities under the regulatory structure. A separate question concerns the activities of banks once they are already organized under a chartering statute. That question concerns what activities we should allow those entities to engage in. This is the second question, and we will look at it after we address the first business of banking issue. As an illustration, I would like you all to take a look at the opinion of the Texas Attorney General on page 122 of the casebook. In many respects, this is an interesting case. It involves, in the first instance, a university that is offering its students a new product. The product is a debit card. I'm not sure if this product is common in China yet, but in the United States, a number of universities take funds from their students and in return issue a debit card, an electronic card that can be used to purchase certain goods and services on the campus. Now, if you read this case, you'll notice a number of interesting things about American banking law. First, if you look at the party that is initiating the action, it's the Texas Banking Agency. Its allegation is that the university in question here has begun to engage in the business of banking, and it is requesting a ruling from the state attorney general that the university's debit card program is in fact the business of banking. The university is in some sense the defendant in this case. It has intervened before the attorney general with a set of briefs arguing that its activities do not constitute the business of banking and therefore should not be subject to the regulation. In many respects, this is an interesting case, and if one reads it carefully, one can see that in other jurisdictions, such as in Florida, similar challenges have arisen. And in fact, when the Florida Attorney General reviewed a comparable program, it concluded that it was in fact the business of banking and therefore prohibited for entities that were not either organized as national banks or state banks. In this case, the Texas Attorney General takes the opposite position. It concludes that it is an authorized activity of the university and not an impermissible banking activity. The analysis is, I think, interesting. What the court is trying to do is to determine whether or not the funds the students provide the university are equivalent to deposits, and whether the payment services the students are entitled to constitute a form of check writing that is typically available only through banking organizations in the United States. If you read the opinion, which I encourage you to do, you will see that there is also a distinction made between the cash withdrawal privileges that the program in Florida allowed and the absence of a cash withdrawal privilege in this case. It's not entirely clear to me why the ability to get cash is so essential to this determination, since in fact the students get value from the debit cards by the goods and services they can receive through the use of the card. It's an interesting question, exactly how this decision should be decided. Clearly, the program that the university is engaged in has certain advantages for the students, but it also comes quite close to being the functional equivalent of a banking operation. One could imagine that if the university were to undertake the program on a larger scale, bringing in more retail operations and greater sums of money, that the activity might be considered to constitute some form of banking activity, and therefore subject to the regulatory structure of the state of Texas. In general, I think this opinion poses an interesting question about regulatory power in the United States and elsewhere, now that there is an increasing amount of electronic commercial activity. One can imagine a variety of variations on the university's program that get progressively nearer to the core banking functions. And one must be able to answer the question of when such activities cross the boundary between facilitating other sorts of commerce and entering into the realm of traditional banking. In my view, in order to determine the difference between electronic commerce and the business of banking, it's necessary to ask the questions that we have already considered in this lecture. In particular, what sort of risks are associated with the activity? Are they comparable to the risks associated with banking? And do they implicate other social and public policies that we impose on banking institutions? So, for example, if entities such as the university in Texas were to gain large amounts of financial resources and to be holding them on behalf of their students and other parties, one might become concerned about the risks imposed on the students and others should the university misuse the funds or for some independent reason become insolvent. Similarly, to the extent that we think funds derived from student deposits should be used in a particular way, such as reinvested in the local community, would we want to impose these sorts of requirements on a university engaged in a payment program of the sort of issue in the Texas Attorney General's letter? Another interesting question, which I pose since we are engaged in a somewhat novel internet activity ourselves, is the ability of governments to successfully impose regulation on electronic commerce of the sort at issue in the Texas Attorney General case. Imagine, for example, that the payment structure were being offered from an offshore internet provider, and that individual customers were willingly opening accounts with that internet provider, transferring funds to that internet provider, and using some sort of card or electronic analog to make payments over the internet. Would it be possible for a government to successfully impose regulation on such an operation? To a large degree, that would depend on the regulation available through the internet. And, as many of you probably know, that is an area that's not yet fully developed in the United States or elsewhere around the world. But it poses an interesting challenge to traditional regulatory structures when financial activities can be moved into the electronic environment. For purposes of this lecture, what I want you to think about and bear in mind is the special problem of defining the business of banking. This is an essential regulatory element for any system of financial regulation. And as you work through our casebook, you will see that at the beginning of each chapter, we discuss for each area of regulation, banking, insurance, securities, investment pools, the basic threshold definitions that are used to determine when regulation should and does apply. So this is a recurring problem that we've looked at here and we'll see again elsewhere in the lecture series. Let me turn now to the second business of banking issue I wanted to discuss. The case here is the Arnold Torres case, which is a famous case in American banking law, and it appears on page 131 of our casebook. In this case, there is no question that we are dealing with a nationally chartered bank that does most of its business by taking deposits from local depositors and lending them out to borrowers. In the case, however, the bank has begun to engage in activity. The activity is the investment of funds in a travel agency. And the question that this case raises is whether or not this would be an authorized line of business for a national bank. So there's a regulated entity here that is proposing to engage in a new activity. Since this is our first case involving regulated banks in the United States, let me just say a few words about the structure of the approval process that this bank has gone through and the nature of the legal challenge that is being presented. The case is being brought by the Arnold Tours Company, which is a travel agency, that it objects to the banks going into this line of business. So one must assume that the Arnold Tours Company is worried about losing business to the new bank-sponsored travel agency. The bank has not done this activity on its own initiative. Rather, it has gone to its primary federal regulator, which is the Comptroller of the Currency, an office of the United States Department of Treasury, and obtained permission for the activity. Let me just describe briefly how that permission was granted. I've already mentioned to you the National Bank Act, which is the chartering statute under which national banks are organized. I also mentioned that Section 24(7) of the National Banking Act allows banks to engage in all such incidental powers as shall be necessary to carry on the business of banking, and then lists a number of enumerated powers. What has happened in this case is the banks in question have persuaded the Comptroller of the Currency to issue a regulation under this provision authorizing national banks to engage in travel agency businesses. So you will see mentioned in the case a section of the CFR, which is the Code of Federal Regulation, our system of national regulations, which are issued under statutes. And in this particular provision, there is express authority for national banks to provide travel services for their customers. The argument in this case is whether or not the Comptroller of the Currency's decision to authorize these activities was a legitimate exercise of power under the national banking statute. So the assumption here is the Comptroller is limited by the words of the National Banking Act, and it's the role of the courts to determine whether or not the Comptroller has complied with the statutory requirements. What the court rules in Arnold Tours is that the Comptroller has gone too far and that travel agency activities are not permissible for national banks. And the Arnold Tours case is famous because it develops a test for determining when activities are or are not permissible for national banks under the National Banking Act. And in essence, what this test requires is that the activities be convenient or useful in connection with the performance of an express power. So the court here is requiring that the acts be closely tied to expressly enumerated powers in the National Bank Act, and it concludes that travel agencies aren't so closely aligned. I should note in passing that this is not the only judicial interpretation in the United States for this particular statutory section. Currently, a few decades later, the Supreme Court, in something known as the Valak decision, which is discussed in the casebook, slightly broadened the scope of national bank powers to allow the comptroller of the currency, in essence, greater discretion for expanding the powers of national banks. But the opinion goes on to state the travel agency activities are still probably not okay. So one of the things that's interesting for you to know is that in the United States there is an ongoing dialogue between the courts and the regulatory agencies, and sometimes Congress, about what the appropriate activities of banks are. And usually this is described as the business of banking test or the business of banking debate. What kinds of activities should banks be permitted to engage in the United States? Returning now to the Arnold Tours case, essentially what the opinion holds is, while it's okay for banks to engage in traditional enumerated powers, such as loans to borrowers, it's no good for them to try to engage in extraneous activities, commercial activities, such as investing in travel agencies. Now, next week, I want to ask you to think harder about this ruling, not so much as a matter of statutory, but as a matter of public policy. What are the reasons for allowing banks to make loans to even travel agents, but not allowing them to make direct investments in travel agents? What are the justifications for that? There are a number of possible reasons you might think about: risk regulation, that is, solvency protection, anti-competitive concerns or antitrust concerns, other public goals associated with financial regulation. All three are possibilities. And I want to begin our lecture next week discussing that. But before leaving this area, let me mention an assignment I'd like members of the class to undertake during the balance of this week. What I would like you to do is to try to answer an exercise that I have distributed on the web page. This is called the Alternative Strategies for Depository Institutions. And in this exercise, I ask you to put yourself in the position of deciding what business choices a depository institution should make. And to help you engage in the exercise, I have given you some background material about a hypothetical intermediary. If you read the exercise, you'll see that it has $100 of assets, is funded with $99 of deposits and $1 of capital, and it has annual expenses of $7. This is a simplified example, of course, and the annual expenses includes all interest costs and administrative costs. And in essence, what I ask you to do in this case is to compare four different strategies, which I label strategy A, B, C, and D. And each strategy has a set of scenarios about what's likely to happen. And let me just describe strategy A, which is displayed on this slide. If the bank pursues strategy A, most likely it will earn 8% on its assets. There's a possibility that things will go bad in the worst case, which will happen a quarter of the time. It will only earn 7%. In the best case, it might earn up to 9%. So on average, you would expect to earn 8%, but that yield may go up or down 1%. Now, you need to think about whether the bank should choose this strategy or the other strategies. And let me just give you one hint about how to think about this. You should think about the implications of the decision for both the owners of the bank and the depositors. Now, looking at the middle case, 8%, if the bank makes 8% on its assets, it has $100 of assets, it will make $8, its expenses for the year are $7, and so its net profit for the owners will be $1. If it makes 7%, it will have profit that will totally equal its cost, so it will make no money, the owners will make nothing. However, if it makes 9%, it will earn profits of $2 for the owners. So on average here, it expects to make its owners $1 of profit, but it may be as high as 2 or as low as 0. Remember, in doing this exercise, that if the institution loses more than a dollar, it will deplete all of its capital. And for losses of more than a dollar, some costs will be passed on to depositors. So the owners will experience losses only up to the $1 that they have invested. So technically speaking, this is a limited liability entity, a limited liability corporation, and the owner's losses are limited to the capital they have invested. So what I'd like you to do is look through the strategies, try to compare them, and then consider what you think is the best strategy for the institution and why. And I'd like you to actually commit yourself to one strategy and an explanation and post it on the discussion group for Lecture 2 by Friday afternoon, March 18th. I want you to post it by then so that I can react to and comment upon your postings in the lecture for next week. So thank you very much. This concludes the second lecture in our series, and I look forward to seeing your posted comments in the coming week. Thank you very much.